This episode is brought to you by White Cloud Coffee Roasters, where every bean tells a story of adventure and passion. Nestled in the heart of Idaho's mountain wilderness, White Cloud has been mastering the craft of coffee for more than 38 years, bringing the spirit of the outdoors into every cup. Discover the difference in their premium beans, meticulously roasted to capture the essence of the mountains. From robust, full-bodied classics to creative flavored blends, White Cloud coffees are designed for you to appreciate the subtleties of premium coffee. Now, listeners of our podcast can get an exclusive 10% discount. Just use the promo code CREATIVITY at checkout. Visit whitecloudcoffee.com and use the code CREATIVITY for your 10% discount. Start your adventure today. Journey to whitecloudcoffee.com. Tap into your most original thinking, organize your ideas, and create the opportunities to launch your creative work. Unlocking your world of creativity with best-selling author and brand innovator, Mark Stinson.
Welcome back, friends, to our podcast, Your World of Creativity. And we do travel the world talking to creative practitioners about their inspiration and where they get their ideas, but also how they gain the confidence and connections to launch the work out into the world. And I'm so happy today to be talking with Angie Alita Newell. Angie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Angie is the author of a great new book called All I See is Violence. And it's been described as a woman warrior, a ruthless general, and a single mother, with those three stories braided together in the legacy of a stolen nation. It's just out from Greenleaf Book Group. Angie, what an exciting time to actually have the book launched, after I know the creative journey that you must have gone through to write it and get it published.
I'm sure that's every writer's journey, right? It's you think, oh, okay, I got this book done. Now I can just put it out there. But it's almost like producing like a music album. there's things you don't even think about, like typesetting. You're like, whoa.
Never thought of this. Yeah. Exactly.
It's well, on pages, so it's good, right?
that's right. And what a creative journey even to get to the book. You're a historian by background. You're blending this whole idea of academic history and university degrees and literature and creative writing, but also with your First Nations background yourself. Where did you decide that you wanted to write this historical fiction kind of genre?
I've been in love with historical fiction since I can remember. I guess it's not actually historical fiction because I grew up on like Charles Dickens and Mark Twain, but reading it from the 20th century, that was historical, even though that was like present for them. And so that era really stuck with me. And I remember the 1970s show. I was born in the early 80s, but I remember Little House on the Prairie. It was through like this 1970s filter. So that also like heavily imprinted on my subconscious. So I just grew up drawn to that era, and I ended up going to school for history, which I started in World War II history, and it just came back to my ancestral lineage. But I got really into the Code Talkers, and my mother was an Air Force pilot, so we have a strong military connection in my family. So just looking at Indigenous participation in that, and like the duality to that is that we were really oppressed by these governments, but we had a lot of honor to represent them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, interesting overlap.
Definitely. Yes. And well, so that led to like spirituality.
I was going to say, was that there was this, you say spiritual, I can see that. This historical connection then to your own family, your own roots, your own heritage.
Oh, definitely. And then you start like looking in like the spiritual teachings of our ancestors that sort of, it's almost mind blowing that it manages to make it through that level of oppression and indoctrination, because we're coming out of Indigenous people in North America. We're coming out of the residential and boarding school eras. So what they did is that they took all the Indigenous children and they placed them in these centers, these education facilities that were run by government appointed educators and different factions of Christian churches, predominantly Roman Catholic. And they abused these kids to forget who and what they were to implement their version of truth. And so somehow our spiritual worldview makes it out of there and we still want to participate in the army.
Yes, yes, that I still want to represent that country.
For sure. So that really, because I grew up in that, that really intrigued me. And it's coming to this understanding, there's not this disassociation between all these beings that facilitates hate. There's this universal love. Despite all these things that have happened, there's still this grounded knowing that this oneness, it doesn't, that transcends gender, ethnicity, all these different constructs that have been implemented upon our perspective. So how do I put that all into one novel?
Mm-hmm. And these diverse characters, all the way from the Cheyenne warrior Little Wolf to General Custer and your character, Nancy Swift Fox. How did you think about telling the three stories, but weaving them together?
I started with General Custer. So I'm Canadian and I was born to the Northwest Territories. I ended up being raised in like a shitty suburb of Vancouver. And so like that Custer, that like American history, like we're not taught that.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
right.
I didn't come across that till university. And what preceded that was a conversation with an elder, and we were sitting at this Musqueam feast, and he just turned to me. He's, did you know that they were female warriors? And that was just that one sentence. And here I was trained as a historian and I was like, no. So I started archival research and dimes to donuts, there it was. Almost 50% of the warriors that the U.S. military met in the field were female. So I started, and that in that research, I was led to General Custer. He wrote all these memoirs. And he was a very flamboyant character. You couldn't help but love this person. There's so many narcissistic tendencies. And he was a valiant fighter when you start going through the American Civil War and the different battles that he participated in. He was very intelligent. He was well-versed. He made smart decisions. To have this person have what went down at the Battle of Bighorn was shocking. And so someone that came into that story with no background, like it was like a Shakespearean tragedy. Like I couldn't believe it. I was like, the whole family, unbelievable. And for someone that was so confident and had won these like big decisive battles against like really strong opponents to go up against a handful of, at this point, they're calling them bands or tribes because we have this like westward expansion and these indigenous groups are being broken up, right? So they're essentially, it's a genocide. So you have these like little kind of like ragtag groups of people. So they're not even at their full strength that they would have been 100 years preceding that. So to have Custer go up against them and lose, it was like, what the heck just happened? So it really interested me.
Yeah. This is where, yes, it's fiction. So you could say the creative process of writing a novel, but you also have to take this research and sort of legitimacy approach to telling the story, right?
Oh, 100%. So I'm trained as a historian. So I based it in archival research and all my information in there. It was essentially like I was writing like a PhD dissertation, like everything I could like annotate. And I had like massive amount of documents and books that I went through to get. And then I combined that just with like little snippets from elders. So we had the convergence of information, and the more information I saw, like it was like synchronicity, like information was just dropped on my lap, or I would just meet somebody and it just built from there. And so it ended up taking a little bit longer than it should have, because I had to like really think, oh, how do I tie this all in? And so where we get the 1970s storyline is we have the American Indian movement on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And this is the same location as the Battle of Little Bighorn. So now we have, we also had the ghost dance that kind of happened in the later 19th century. So Sitting Bull, he makes it through that battle and they don't kill him. He escapes Canada, he comes back and he starts like facilitating like a new spirituality. And so what happened is that the U.S. government sees this and this renewal of faith, and they go in and they slaughter that whole CU group. So I didn't include that in there, but that also happened between those two events, but all in the same spot. So that interested me as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't help but wonder as you were writing this, your own revelations, and what came to you as an Indigenous person yourself and as this Indigenous writer. Did you feel that you were trying to conceal, uncover, reveal new facts? Because oftentimes we think, oh, we know all about that, the army and the Little Bighorn. Yeah. But You're taking a different angle at revealing some of these new insights.
Oh, definitely. Like it's even looking at the concept of race. So that doesn't come up. Like the idea of that doesn't even emerge in our worldview in Western society to the late 19th century. These people, they wouldn't have had any, oh, the white people are bad like that. The indigenous people wouldn't have thought like that. And you can actually see there's a heavy prevalence of mixed race going on. And I've spoken about this with a few other people. General Custer, when they're negotiating the treaty, the Fort Laramie Treaty, he's specifically saying, you got to keep those squaw men out. So the squaw men were the white Americans that married indigenous women. So it's a matriarchal society. So if I were to get married, then my husband would take my name and he would be expected to come to my community. And so these men left whatever American existence, colonial existence they had, and went essentially Indian. And so the U.S. government targeted them and called them squaw men, because when they started negotiating the treaties, because they had a broader world view of how that system worked, they could negotiate a better deal. So they were like, no, these people got to go. And of course, they had children, and those children's rank, they rose up through the ranks as well. And you have chiefs like Quanah, who's half white, that became very respected chiefs and guiding members. So we have this like mismatch, like we don't just have this linear. And then there's also, I didn't get into it in this book because I didn't really find it in those tribes that I was studying, but we have like African-American slaves, and they went on to form like whole, like half like indigenous, like Black Indians, essentially. And then the flip side of that, I couldn't include in this book either. You have freed African-American slaves that go on to fight in the military, and they form whole infantry groups, and they're also fighting the Indians. So you have all these like dualistic sort of things going on, and it's all, none of it's like black and white, it's all gray.
Yes.
like it depends on the individual. So you see like right now, things are being taught, oh no, those people are bad. It's like, that's a pretty, someone who's like doing something unethical is super individualistic and irregardless of ethnicity.
Yes. And I wondered what you thought of that idea. And it's so controversial in schools now, and that we're calling it critical race theory. Like somehow we're criticizing the, I guess, actions of our past, and we're supposed to feel bad about that. But where does the reconciliation, where does the sort of apologetic or reparation kind of movement start coming into these thoughts?
Yeah, that's a big question.
It's huge.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a huge question.
It's all on your shoulders, Angie. We're looking
well,
for the...
There's something I got into this book as well. There's another dualistic nature in that the indigenous people weren't necessarily fighting for indigenous rights, right? Mm. We have the indigenous people who signed deals with the U.S. government and became scouts and hunted the other Indians to get
yes.
them in
yes.
line. So... So I think I don't agree with that at all. Like we can't criticize. We need to look as like observers from like a non-judgmental point of view. Because as soon as you start casting judgment, you have that duality. And that goes against indigenous spirituality. That goes against our worldview. And that's what our ancestors fought for. So we need to remember these things so we don't repeat them. But you have to look at it from a non-judgmental point of view. And like what the school systems appear to be doing is reinforcing judgments. And that's like the worst thing we can do for our children. We should be as worthy adults, and we need to not act like children.
Very strong. And just thinking about the stories, not only in your novel, but in others, but the idea that hearing each other and knowing your stories can help bridge those gaps, do you think?
Oh, definitely. So like as I mentioned, I grew up on 19th century English fiction, like English literature, like out of England. Like I had a very turbulent childhood, and I really connected with Oliver Twist. Like that was a book like I would go back to again and again. And here I am. I'm not male. I'm a female. I'm not white. I'm indigenous. But having that sort of empathy and that connection to the human experience, I think opens up those boundaries.
Great. What other messages or takeaways do you think readers might take away from the book? It's a very provocative title to begin with. All I See is Violence.
Yeah, that ended up being like one of the I don't think this is a spoiler, but it ends up being like one of the sentences towards the end of the novel. But like my working title was Custer's Last Stand. So it's funny how I wasn't happy with that title. But like when you're in the creative process, you're like, oh, that's good enough for now. That's just, yeah, that's why I know, okay, that's the Custer notebook I'm looking for. So I pick up my Custer's Last Stand. That was a very violent point in history, not just in American history. Like you see, we're actually witnessing that now. Like we're watching these sort of historical patterns play out on a global stage. And so there's lots of wars in Europe at this point in time. Like the US is in chaos. Canada's got its own like little chaotic thing going on. So it's like the world's in like upheaval.
And where can we take that? In other words, can't we say that we know more than we did then? And like you said earlier, that we learn in order to not repeat these things.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You have to not acquiesce into that paradigm of hate. You have to stand firm and no, we're not going to cast judgment. We're just going to observe and we're going to figure out a compromise. Like I'm a mother to children, and when they're toddlers, you're like a UFC referee. and as they grow and develop and you have these like good talks and they're getting older, like my kids no longer physically fight. Like now once in a while there's some like harsh like tones, but even there, like the language is pretty neutral. They express like emotional frustration, but that's what you hope to ground in your children, right? Like you get out of 2, 3 and it's no, you don't need to punch someone in the face to get your point across. So like if I think that could apply to the world.
Very good. Yeah. I do too. Well, we're talking with Angie Alita Newell about her new book, All I See Is Violence. Angie, I wondered if you could read a little excerpt and so we can get a feel for the tone.
I find myself weaving through the frozen trees. There is a river nearby. A deep part I had seen in the daylight had thin ice. They had been ice fishing on it earlier in the week. I see it where I had left it, a rock the size of my head at the base of a spruce that reminded me of my brother and the games we used to play. I think of my mother sitting in the tall grass weaving baskets, her fingers so slender, deft, and quick, and my father smiling and sharpening his axe. I walk towards the rock and find myself singing a song the women who had been there, who had seen what I had seen, brought back to the agency with them. Long hair, long hair. I was short of guns, and you brought me many. Long hair, I was short of horses, and you brought me many. I stop singing and feel someone looking at me. I look behind me, under the first glow of the rising sun. I see Shaw some distance from me. I pause, waiting for her to come to me, to tell me I'm foolish. I feel the words come from my mouth in a scream. Today is a good day to die, I call to her. The words are carried to her on the wind.
So good. Thanks for sharing that. That's Angie Alita Newell reading from her new book, All I See Is Violence, just out now from Greenleaf Book Group. We've been talking about some of these deep historical and cultural insights, but what about your own creative process? What did you learn about yourself in the creative development process?
I think you get to these points when you're writing and you're working as an artist, where you have a small moment where you're like, I wonder if I should not write that. I want to write that, but I wonder if other people read this, should I not write that? Should I not share that much, be like that vulnerable? And you said that in your beginning. So you have to, and in choosing vulnerability, which I did, you learn a deeper version of yourself. You ended up, you're expressing truth now. You're not expressing an illusion. So I think people can connect with that. And I think if you're not in that vulnerable, truthful state, I think that truth rubs you the wrong way.
And what is it about, boy, that word vulnerability, it comes up a lot, that we need to be our real selves and show more of ourselves than maybe we feel comfortable with. So that really struck with you as you were developing this book, huh? That there were parts that you said, I'm not sure I should be showing that side of myself or my thoughts or what have you.
Or like my perspective on what's going on with the Indigenous communities, because they need healing. I come out of that, like I see what's going on. And it's like, you get to a point in your growth and development where I was reaching when I was developing this novel, where you're like observing and you're like, whoa, whoa, like, why are so many people in prison? Why is there so much domestic violence? Why is there so much sexual violence? What is going on here? Like, why are reservations like prison camps? And so, as I'm an inquisitive mind, I just always ask, like, why? Instead of a younger version of me would have gotten upset, and I no longer get angry because you're observing, because you're coming from that vulnerability where you're okay to explore these two. So it's one thing doing that on a personal level, it's another doing it on a public level. So you get to that point as an artist where you're like, okay, like I like accept and I'm exploring these truths, but should I share these truths? And even like the different indigenous knowledge shared from me from the elders, we get into like ceremonies and the Sundance, like those are based off of true stories and that like connection to the divine and how they would like summon that sort of connection. And that sort of, they didn't have one day where they went to worship, like they worshiped like every minute of every day. Like everything was essentially like a religious ceremony, whether it was gathering your food, like sitting to eat, like celebrating a marriage, celebrating a birth, like honoring a death. There's all these different, like pretty stringent protocols. And there's no jails because if you didn't conform, they just asked you to leave. And chances are, like, you wouldn't survive. So you're like, I don't want to do these things. I want to do bad things, but I'm not going to survive on my own. So like they didn't take any prisoners. Like you either reformed, they killed you, or you're just exiled. Huh?
Yes. You talk about maybe reactions, and you mentioned judgment before, but what have been some of the reactions? It's great to read the reviews. In other words, hey, it's a work of art, it's a great book, which it is. But what about in your community? Have you
In my
received,
community, they're
yes.
actually really excited. They're like, whoa, somebody finally said the quiet part
Yes,
out
what
loud.
I was
They're like,
thinking too, yes.
yeah, they're like, yes, finally someone's saying it. And I want to write it from like you see these sort of like romanticized versions of what's going on. Like I wanted, like when you read like Ernest Hemingway, there's a harshness to his prose. Like I wanted to have like that fiction that guided me as a small human kind of anchor in that. Like those people weren't scared to tell the truth, whether you were looking at Shakespeare, you're looking at Hemingway, you're looking at Virginia Woolf, like you're looking at T.S. Eliot. Like they weren't afraid to be like, yeah, this is how I see it, channeling that confidence. And I think in a lot of ways, right now, talking about like critical race theory, like people are starting to operate in like groupthink. It's no, like those writers at that point in time in Western culture, they really celebrated critical thinking and individuality. And so I ended up doing my undergraduate degree in England. And there they were like, no, don't tell me what you read, tell me what you think. And having that sort of anchor my education, like gave me the courage to step forward with that. But when I came back to Canada, I went to the University of British Columbia, and that was inverted. It was like, oh, don't really tell me what you think. Tell me, reiterate, like paraphrase another historian. I could see like the duality in the education there. And that was a long time ago now. That was like 20 years ago. So I don't know what it's like now.
Oh,
Hopefully.
that's ancient history, 20 years.
Right, that's too.
We talk about learning how to think, and this goes to the heart of this creativity podcast, even. It's we're trying to think creatively. And sometimes many people have said the schools beat it out of us and conforming and just echoing what other people have said. But you're really underscoring this idea that we need to be critical. Not meaning judgmental necessarily or criticism, but we need to be critical in our thinking.
That's true. So I went to public school in Canada, and I've always been a critical thinker. And in elementary school and high school, I got in a lot of
Yeah, we're
trouble.
not always big fans of critical thinking
It
in elementary
was so
school,
funny
especially.
because I got an email through my website out of someone I went to high school with, who I haven't spoken to in 20 or some odd years. And I actually had forgotten that. And they brought it up in the email because they wanted a signed copy of my book. Because they were like, you were never afraid to tell the teachers the truth. I think it's deciding that you can live in your truth, but from a loving way. Like it doesn't have to be this combative sort of like me against them. It's just, oh no, I'm just a human expressing my perspective. And I'll literally read like anything. Like I'm super open-minded when it comes to other people's art as well. So if you're going to teach that medicine, you have to be able to take that medicine.
And I know you're relishing in the book just being released, so I'm not going to say, so what's next? Everybody, what's next?
Well, actually,
Well, I
I've
want to
been.
enjoy what I've got now,
Yeah, no,
but
I have,
I wanted to ask you
but you
about
know, for me,
aspirations.
it's like a child that's grown up and gone out of the house now.
Yes,
All I
very
see is
good.
violence. It's like, oh, you're on your own now. I'm moving on to my next egg. And I'm currently working on a story about Geronimo. And so like General Crook, he makes it through the Battle of Little Bighorn and he gets assigned to Geronimo. And Geronimo is a fascinating figure because they weren't able to capture him. They kept on trying to imprison him and he kept on getting away. So he ends up fighting the US military for close to 3 decades. And so he fought alongside the warrior chief Magnus Colorado, Cochise, we have Victorio. And Victorio had a sister, Lozen, who was a medicine woman and fought alongside them. And there's a whole team, here we go again, indigenous female warriors in this Apache community. So I'm just finishing up my archival research with that. I'm just starting to craft the story. And there's like a tremendous amount of like wisdom in there that kind of is similar to this book, but then totally different on its own.
It's exciting.
It's really exciting.
Yeah, that's good. You already have that percolating. That's good. I love that. Very good. Angie, I can't thank you enough for the wonderful conversation and telling us kind of the insights and the backstories of the book. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And where can we go to find more about you and your work?
I have a website, angiealitanewald.com, and there's an Instagram link there, and then you can find me on all the major book places.
It will definitely be checking those out. And listeners, this idea that we can take history and look at it from different views, different angles, just the three characters in Angie's book, but look at how many ways we've explored today, how we need to appreciate the stories that other people bring. And maybe that'll help the world be a better place.
I think it definitely will.
Listeners, come back again next time. We've stamped our creative passport in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada today, but we're going to continue our around-the-world journeys, and we'll be talking to creative practitioners everywhere about how they get inspired and organize their ideas, but most of all, how they make the connections and gain the confidence to launch their work out into the world. So until next time, I'm Mark Stenson, and we'll keep unlocking your world of creativity.
Unlocking Your World of Creativity with best-selling author and brand innovator, Mark Stinson. This program was produced by BSB Media, creators of IntelliKey Leadership Stories, Unlocking Your World of Creativity, and ThePeaceRoom.love.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America.
I joined the Navy to serve my country. While parachuting with my platoon, my parachute didn't open, and I broke my neck.
Thanks to PVA, paralyzed veterans are getting specialized medical care and treatments, the jobs they want, and the accessible vehicles and homes they need.
I just don't think my family would be as happy as they are without the support that I received from Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Learn more at PVA.org.